Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Hello once again, podcast and ODR audience, and welcome to this next one in the iCoder podcast series. I'm Ian McDuff, and your host for the series, and once again, and still am with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague in the ODR world, Dr. Janet Martinez. Janet is a Senior Lecturer Emeritus and retired Director of the Martin Daniel Gould Center for Conflict Resolution at Stanford Law School. Janet taught negotiation, advanced negotiation, dispute systems design, and ADR law and policy. She's practiced corporate law for 10 years in San Francisco, latterly as Senior Counsel for McKesson's Corporation's Acquisition and Divestitures. She was senior consultant to the Consensus Building Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is a long established body, isn't it? The CBI.
Yes.
And some good names there, where she now serves on the board of directors. And Janet does corporate executive negotiation training with, here comes another well established name, the Lex Sabanius Negotiation Group. They're part of the woodwork in the negotiation field. As well as with law firms in North America and abroad. Jan received her BS in bacteriology from Washington State University, JD from Golden Gate University, MPA from Harvard, and her PhD from MIT. Janet has published extensively in the ODR field with a strong focus on the design of ODR systems, in particular ethical ODR systems, which is a field to which we'll return in a minute. Her work includes published work includes dispute systems design, preventing, managing, and resolving conflict from Stanford University Press in 2020, ODR and innovation in the US with Amy Schmitz in the major text on ODR, online dispute resolution theory and practice, and designing ethical online dispute systems, the rise of the fourth party with Colin Rule. We're quite familiar names coming through here, people we've chatted with already. She and Amy Schmitz also have a forthcoming book, Digital Dispute Systems Design, which I hope we can talk about shortly. Janet, thank you for taking the time to join me in this podcast series. It's great to talk with you again and to see you there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ian, for inviting me and for the warm welcome. And I recall with great pleasure our visit of having the ODR Forum in Auckland. Sorry I can't come and join you again on the North Island and the South Island.
Well, who's to say you can't? these days, of course, with our green credentials firmly intact, we ought to be careful about the amount of flying we do, I suppose.
Right. Yeah.
But it's nevertheless, the invitation's always there. Jan, there's a couple of things that mentioned in the introduction, the areas of your particular and your current work you have done and work you're continuing to do in the disputes design or dispute systems design field. This must be top of mind to you as you're currently working on that field on the book with Amy. Can you say something about two aspects of this? One is the general field of dispute systems design, which has been around for some time really as part of the ADR field. And secondly, what particular issues do we need to pay attention to in the digital design field?
I want to thank my colleagues in the field of system design as it has unfolded over the last, I guess, 20 some years. Yuri Brighton Goldberg, I think, wrote Getting Disputes Resolved. And that was followed by, Ethan Cash and Orna. Ine Rabinovich and their work on system design, and Nancy Rogers also wrote a wonderful handbook on system design. So I think as academics are wont to do, is we want to name what we do in an interesting way. It may not be new and different, but maybe a different lens. So my colleagues and co-authors, Lisa Amsler and Stephanie Smith, and I had spent a number of years teaching system design and trying to define what's there and and try to share it in an accessible way. It's just a fancy word. System design is of how do you put processes together, either one or more, so that help you prevent, manage, and resolve disputes. And so our thought was, when we were teaching, is all the items or elements, reference points that we thought students would benefit from. And what we came up with, I think 23 things that you should know before you design a system. And I suggested that 23 was too many. Students are not going to remember that many things.
Three maybe.
So we shrunk it down. Yeah, three would have been better, but we shrunk it down to six. And of that, we thought the most important element is the goal and thinking about what are you trying to accomplish, which disputes, what category of disputes are you trying to focus on? And among the elements that might specify your goals, what is a sample goal and how many goals can you have? So we thought, well, justice seems an important goal, efficiency in the process, both for the user and the provider. It could be a process that is fair, procedural justice. It could be the experience or voice that a party experiences going through the process. So these all sound like what we would say in US, like mom and apple pie. They're all great and we want them all, but somewhere along the way, someone is making a choice. And so there are a couple things. One is the status quo, for the most part, is already in place. And there are people who like that process and that system and don't want it to change. And so I think trying to figure out what are the priorities of those goals and who gets to decide? And is it, who are the stakeholders and what are their interests? What are their goals and how do those fit together? So I think trying to help regular people as well as lawyers advising their clients to think about very concretely, what are we trying to accomplish? And what are the tools that we have to play with? All the processes, the forums, and the fuss of Frank Sanders' work, and really thinking about having a conversation. So goals, most important. Stakeholders, who cares? Who's affected by these choices? And are we designing a brand new system? Or are we redesigning an existing system that clearly has political implications? Culture and context. Is this a disaster like Hurricane Katrina? And we need to act quickly and serve the people that have been harmed. Is there some other process that is triggered? Thinking about evaluation. Did we do a good job with our system? How are we measuring it? What are the metrics? And how could we improve it? So, and I think evaluation, unless you have a goal, it's really hard to know if you achieved your goal in terms of the evaluation. The other issue that I wanted to touch on is resources. Do you have enough resources to make the system work? That's technological, which is what we'll talk more about today. Is it financial? Do you have enough money and resources to pay for putting the system in place to be most effective? Do we have training? Are we training our users? Are we training our providers so that they are actually delivering a quality process for people? So I think we can loop back around. What the online dispute resolution domain now raises is the whole notion of technology, and how can we use technology to tap information sooner, and therefore try to think about what technologically, what can we do to specify our goals, quantify our goals, and come and move forward in that way.
It occurs to me that you're actually, I mean, that's a wonderful overview of the DSE field, but it occurs to me what you've also outlined is a radical shift in our thinking about legal systems in the last probably 40 years, because prior to the 1970s, probably, so we're looking 50 years really, it would never have occurred to lawmakers that anyone other than they had a view about designing systems. And yet here you are outlining not only what academics might want to have to say about legal processes, but also what that category of people you referred to quite rightly as stakeholders, all the other people who are likely to have an interest in how dispute systems, not just legal systems, but dispute systems work. So it's a radically different ecology, isn't it, or ecosystem of disputes, where more stakeholders, more people get to have a say in what works. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, your work on dispute systems design is bigger than that. It's more ambitious, because it's actually about how we, almost going back to the anthropology of how cultures deal with disputes. So it's I hadn't thought about this until you did your lovely outline there, that this is actually quite a radical rethinking of who gets to have a say in how systems work.
Yes.
It's a big project you've got here.
It that's why it took so long to write the book. But I'm in a fortunate situation where the original article that Stephanie Smith and I wrote in 2007 has been invited to be critiqued this spring. And so a number of estimable colleagues are going to critique our article and how valuable it is or isn't in current times. Mm-hmm. And so we are looking forward to hearing what the critique is, and maybe we can improve the framework that we put forward in the book of system design. So this is a valuable point in time to reassess. Did we capture the essential elements? Have we missed something? Has the world changed? Has the context for, like you were saying, for dispute resolution, prevention, evaluation, has that changed? And are those old-fashioned or out of sync with the needs of our society now?
Yeah, because when I think of having read the Uri Bretton Goldberg book when it came out, nearly four decades ago, what was powerful about that was the commentary, as I remember, on designing disputes at a micro level, and recognizing that different disputes, different contexts, whether it's employment or family or wherever, require different interventions. But you are looking at something not only at that level, but also at the macro level, sort of the cultural level of how we deal with disputes in our worlds. Maybe I'm putting words into your mouth that you didn't intend.
I appreciate you crafting a way of framing this.
Because it's one thing important to think about how, say, in any particular industry or even any workplace, you design disputes for that particular context. But the ambition is necessarily larger than that, isn't it? We're dealing with the range of cultural, ethnic, gender, etc., all those inputs that now go into a world in which we have greater expectations about our participation in the design of our worlds. We are no longer merely passive recipients of what is done unto us.
Yeah. So I had a link to what you just said, Ian. I heard David Brooks give a lecture this week. Mm-hmm. He's written a new book about relating with other people.
Yep.
And it's on how do you listen deeply to others, and mm-hmm. how are you listened to deeply by others in both directions. And yep. I think it was a really powerful concept, although very simple, in how well we listen to each other and mm-hmm. have the capacity to listen to each other and then engage by whether it's a structured legal decision or whether it's a consultative restorative justice process. And how can we engage and advance that in a more human way, but also taking advantage, tapping the technology that maybe can enhance our capacity both to listen and speak. These are pretty basic concepts that we've been wrestling with in conflict resolution for a long time and centuries in our cultures.
Quick question, is that the David Brooks who writes in the New York Times?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was written earlier on character. And I saw a reference to his book in the online version of the New York Times. I must go look for that. But again, what you raised there is both for us very familiar, those of us in the dispute resolution feel very familiar about attention, about listening, about participation. But it's also, if you look at the history of dispute resolution, it's quite radically different, isn't it? In the sense that we've shifted from a vertical system of dispute resolution, hierarchical, to a much more horizontal participatory mm-hmm. system. But our institutions, I think, are still struggling to deal with that.
Yeah.
And so you're designing participation in institutions which aren't necessarily fit for purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or are you? Well, let me ask you about your own ambition in relation to this work. Are you and Amy? We'll come back to the digital part in a moment. But are you and Amy thinking about institutional design, or are you thinking about the ways in which disputants and their representatives can participate or can create for themselves new ways of dealing with the disputes? It's either fitting into the existing structures or being much more innovative.
So I can go two different spectrums that I'm imagining. Yeah. On the one hand, we have a history, and for centuries, a civilization our respective societies have tried to come up with a structure to justice, some form of how do we set the boundaries and structure our relationships so that they respond to our values, and how do we make those structures trustworthy? And I think Ethan talked a lot about this in our fourth party article, in thinking about the importance of trust. Do we trust the structures that we have put in place and the processes that are used to either intervene or mandate our societies? Now we have moved into a time in which we have increasing role of machine learning. Yep. And we also have our humanness that we have already developed as a society. And how do we merge these two in an effective way, whatever we decide effective is, in thinking about how that works? And so Chris Draper and Leah Wing have have tried to come up with a spectrum that shows starting at one end with the human element. Humans make the law. Humans decide who's in the right and whose rights have been abrogated. And so thinking about how that at one end of the spectrum morphs into a machine learning arena that makes decisions in its own way. It may either gather the data, so we just know we have a lot more information at our fingertips, or it could be that we've changed the nature of what justice looks like. And so moving from some human and or all human to some human and some machine to all machine. And going back to the goals that we talked about, if efficiency, if access to justice means more people get access to a process that structures our behaviors, what does that look like? And what does it look like when we have machines who actually make the decisions? They predict what will happen and they dictate what the decision outcome will be. And so at writ large, who makes the rules and who imposes them and who decides? We're struggling with this. Yeah.
The kind of interesting pronoun shift there. I mean, I don't know if it's intentional or not. When you refer to machines, the role of machines in this, when machines who make the decisions, and mm-hmm. that's kind of personifying the machines. I mean, old-fashioned linguist way, I'd say machines which make decisions. But it's interesting, isn't it, when we think of decision making, we think of it as a human function. Mm-hmm. Because that's what we've been used to for the last God knows how many millennia.
Right.
So it's almost an understandable shift to think of machines making the same kinds of decisions that we make, because I guess after all, humans are behind the capacity that machines have. Mm-hmm. So can we segue from that to the particular element of your disputes design work with Amy? About how you factor in, or you're thinking of factoring in, the digital element in this conversation, because it is, hope not too Aldous Huxley like, this is a brave new world, because mm-hmm. the dispute systems design of Yuri Breton Goldberg was not about machines.
It was
about the fact that we can think about negotiation, mediation, arbitration, conciliation, expert opinion, and now we've got this whole new world of machines, of digital technology being able to help or hinder. So how do you factor this in?
Well, I looked back at our outline for our book and looking at the goals, and the thing that I added to that we have added to the goals is not just what are the disputes we want to address and what kind of metric do we want to measure it by. We added on how does technology facilitate achieving those goals. So does technology help us because it has access to so much more information? So we aren't just anecdotally making a decision or structuring that process. We are actually trying to get more data so we can say there is a significant difference or a significant cause and effect. So I think to answer the first part of your question is it's the use of data. But data is very overwhelming, right? And where does it come from? Who generated it? Is there any filtering system? Is it regulated? So I think that's the piece that we're also looking at, is how do we regulate the gathering and the use of data? And who makes those choices? And I think overlaid with that is, who are the professionals who are qualified to do that task? Lawyers like to think of ourselves as the leaders of justice, in designing justice and advancing it. But at the same time, what if we use a machine instead of a person to gather that data, sort it, determine whether it's legitimate and trustworthy or not? So I think I've given a rather scattered answer to your question.
Not at all. Because I mean, there's an immediate provocation in there, which I imagine more lawyerly types than myself would want to ask. I mean, one of the core issues in any court is the admissibility of evidence. Because even in human terms, we can gather more evidence, more information than is relevant. And our data mining machines, whether it's Google or Amazon or whoever, or the clever little algorithms of YouTube, which decide what it is that they want you to watch. Not all of that is relevant. And how do you design in admissibility barriers or filters? Is that part of your concern to build those in, or think that those need to be built in somehow? Because not everything that can be said needs to be said.
Yeah. I'm thinking, I lost a thought there. I'm thinking about the challenges of intervention. Who should intervene and when? And the social nature of establishing boundaries and then determine whether the boundaries have been breached. Cool. And is a machine capacity better? Can it gather more data, more inputs, more perspectives? Because one of the questions that we're wondering about is whose perspective is important to us, and whose voice will enhance the depth of our thinking and decision making. And I'm not sure how we're processing that. So as a society, we're treating data and people and decision making differently than we were 50 years ago. And is this in a good way? Is it a more thoughtful process, more voices and perspectives integrated into it? That could be a positive, but it can also be a challenge, because it's just way more complicated. The more stakeholders we draw into our conversation to make decisions and choices, the more difficult it will be as a process. It's just really messy. But is that messiness valued, or is predictability more valued? And so I can imagine predictability. Machine can give us more predictability. We can gather more and different kinds of data to guide us in the choices that we're making. We just make it messy. So Kleros, for example, have you had someone from Kleros talk about their decentralized decision?
No, I haven't.
So Kleros has it's basically crowdsourcing decisions.
I've come across that.
Thinking about a decentralized, that if you can let a jury gather a thousand flowers blooming, can gather and they come up with a decision as a body, is that a better decision? Because it's been the decision making responsibility and structure has been spread out, and so I think thinking about decentralized justice, decentralized decision making, and is a really intriguing shift and from where we have been traditionally and where our decision making might go. But we're used to having judge and jury and our lawyers in robes and looking very full of gravitas. And is that an important quality, the culture of decision making? Is that shifting now in these current times in using a digital domain for making choice?
It's just thinking, your comments remind me of a book that I came across. I can't remember the author. It was a German legal academic. The book was titled something like Justice as Efficiency. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the many books that I had to leave behind in Singapore because I couldn't bring everything home when I returned in 2016. But as it's one of the dilemmas that you allude to in your earlier comment a couple of minutes ago with our dealing with the fundamentally messy nature of human interaction, that we don't fit neat categories. On the one hand, and on the other hand, we have the capacity for things to be better organized, to be more efficient. It's a tension, isn't it? And it becomes, it's both a tension in design, but also in ethics. You know, what is it we're going to prefer? Are we going to prefer efficient, crisply organized systems, which may produce results, but they're not always going to be the right results? And I have absolutely no idea where I'd go on that one. I was troubled by the book when I read it on justice as efficiency, which is probably one of the reasons why I left it behind in Singapore, apart from the fact that I couldn't bring them all home. But your other topic you just raised, I mean, the idea of the possibility and the legitimacy of crowdsourcing answers to legal dilemmas. I mean, Iceland tried that a few years ago after the 2008 financial collapse and the collapse of the government and the collapse of the banking system. They planned to crowdsource a new constitution. In the end, it didn't work out. How does crowdsourcing fit into your current thinking where you and Amy are going in this design and particularly the digital? Because crowdsourcing is much easier with dispute system design. And as a slightly trivial aside, you may be aware that here in New Zealand, the Forest and Bird Organization ran their annual Bird of the Year competition, but it was the Bird of the Century competition. And because of a slight glitch in the voting rights, it turned out that anybody in the world could vote. And John Oliver, bless his little socks, decided that this would be a good campaign. And he started a campaign to support one particular bird. It's a threatened species, so well worth supporting. Something over 300,000 votes came in from 95 countries or wherever. Normally they get 5,000 votes, but who gets to vote? Who gets a voice in the crowdsourcing stuff? I mean, on the one hand, it was wonderfully ridiculous, and it raised the profile of New Zealand's threatened species. On the other hand, there's a level of indignation that somebody out there could basically skew the vote. But as John Oliver said, look, this is perfect American democracy interfering in other people's democracies, or at least not interfering in other people's voting systems. But trivial examples aside, if you look at the capacity of digital tools to bring in things like crowdsourcing votes, how do you manage something like who gets to vote? How do you weigh the votes? How do you ask the question in the first place?
Mm-hmm. I agree on what the question is going to be. Yes. Ian, I do not have an answer to that question. That is the question. But I think maybe breaking down, having a conversation about why we care. I mean, what is the thing that what is the value that we hold highest? And we is a constellation of of people and cultures and perspectives. And we're broken down into political economic systems or chunks, and thinking about how do we have this conversation. And I think different cultures have approaches from different places. And if it is, I don't know who gets to decide if the value list that we've come up with is legitimate for our purposes, and whether we're going to vote on it by war, conquering who takes over what geography, or the argument of ideas. And so that's meandering a bit, but I think the basic question is, as a group of people, citizens, making a choice on what matters most, and that we are willing to sign on and be citizens of this land, if we can, if we feel it's a trustworthy aggregation of people and principles.
It's an interesting question, though. In a way, what you are anticipating, for example, with the sort of almost a voting mechanism, is a different kind of jury selection. It's a much larger jury pool, and makes it much harder to do a jury selection. And of course, these days, with ease of communication, everybody can have an opinion about everything. Not always well informed, almost invariably not well articulated, and possibly not legitimate. And so, you know, a lot of the design and history of legal and dispute processes has involved putting boundaries around through rules, putting boundaries around participation and engagement. And the digital world that we're part of offers on the one hand the removal of boundaries, and on the other hand a different set of digitally designed boundaries. And I'm intrigued to know how, because you've just set me off here, I'm afraid. It's your fault entirely. I mean, because there's an array of provocations that you raise here, which in fact I hope that listeners to this will be able to respond to one way or the other. This is intriguing to know how we design in the digital world, how we design boundaries. And I don't know whether you've begun to think about that or thought about that in your previous work. Boundaries to participation, boundaries to rulemaking. I don't know where I'm going with that, but
I'm glancing at the case studies that Amy and I are playing with. And they have different permutations of what we have just been talking about. So social media, for example, how do we deal, who gets to see what information and with what boundaries on expressing those ideas? So social media, we can decide, then we've got confidentiality, for example. EU has the Data Privacy Act on public information, private information, where that information can flow, who says so. So thinking about the information flows, and there are different ways of regulating that. So I think that's a question. Are there different kinds of courts that have different kinds of priorities in the behavior of parties? So for example, there are a new court, care courts that we have in California, and thinking about, some people are more challenged in being able to, they may have either psychological troubles, or they may have behavior troubles, and they need support of some kind of social system, and can we make then less strict rules in those courts for those people? So different behavior norms. We can think about AI compliance systems, either to come up, as I mentioned to you briefly when we started, I have given my students a chance to use AI. And I said, I have three different kinds of writing that I'm asking of you. Why don't you try AI and see if it helps you in some way? And if so, how? And one is you just write a review of the readings for the week and what our discussion in class was. Number two, you can summarize the reading. I would rather that you read my book, but but if you want to run my book through AI and say, I want a 2-paragraph synopsis of Jan's book written for a high school student, you can do that and decide that's how much information I want from Jan's book. And then last, I asked my students to craft a system of their own or revise a system that already exists. And then you could certainly ask for a first draft from your AI. And then as long as you tell me what you asked AI, what you got for an answer from AI, and how you used it. So so anyway, I'll see what my papers look like, but there are different ways of absorbing information and translating into the specifics of a given conflict situation.
Okay. As a now retired academic, I have an in-house question for you. I mean, I find that an intriguing exercise to ask your students, but how do you grade the students' work? Are you grading them on the question they ask or on the use that they have made of the AI-generated work? What is it that's actually being evaluated?
The care they put into the given situation. Mm-hmm. So Colin and I teach together and a class on system design, and we ask people to draw us the happy path. You know, what is the happy path for this category of dispute? How do you process it? What kind of system do you recommend? And how mm-hmm. are you using ODR tools to do that? So I think the care with which they define their space and the process that they believe would advance either prevention, managing, or resolving the dispute in that category. So the more thoughtful they are about making sure they've gotten the perspective and the voice of all the different stakeholders and imagined a process that addresses those needs, that's how I grade.
Okay. I don't envy you the task of doing that. I must say, and also now I'm no longer part of that world. Grading is one of the things I do not miss.
Love the reading. I love the reading of their papers.
True,
right?
True. Yeah. Well, not invariably, but you know, but quite often. But no, it's, I think what I admire here in what you're doing is that you're assisting your students to move into the world which they are going to be part of, which we have not been. I mean, we're just sort of scratching around the edges and working out how to make sense of this world. They are the digital natives, aren't they? That we, you know, and we're the digital migrants, and we're still opinions formed in the old world back there. So I admire the project. So have you had experience enough so far with this experiment to be able to say how it's going?
I asked them to share with me their impressions so far last week. And we're not to the end of term, but I wanted, is this useful? I mean, is it would you do this again? Would you ask AI to read my book and give you a summary? And I think a lot of students felt that, you know, under time pressure, that it can be pretty helpful. But you have to be pretty careful how you pose the question, and that what they have learned, what they have learned is how they define their question and frame it, and the prompts they give the AI makes a huge amount of difference. And I read them an article from the paper last week where somewhere between, I think it's 3% and 20-some percent of summary of a fact was found to be a hallucination. So, I mean, putting facts in there that were not in the original document. And so realizing just how wild and crazy the result can be, and if you have to trust it, and if you're billing it, you know, $500 an hour for your opinion,
you don't want hallucination.
Don't worry. Yeah, that doesn't feel like a wise choice. But they at least can see that there's a use, there's a tool. Other people are going to be using it, so it's good to be proficient and know how to be a good consumer of that capacity. Writing an idea like a birthday card for, you know, my daughter, you know, that probably works. I've heard AI can even have a sense of humor and make a drawing to go with it. So I think in some creative ways, students have found it, you know, very useful and fun. And then I think as far as doing a research paper, we'll have to see how that goes. Because if they decide, they don't have to use AI. But if they decide to use it, they need to tell me what the prompt was and how they used it. And whether that was a helpful first draft is my guess. It might be a very helpful first draft, but not necessarily what you want for your final product.
The way you're describing it, it requires discernment at both ends. One is discernment in terms of what's worth asking, and learning how to ask good questions, because that's the garbage in, garbage out idea. Yeah. The other is the discernment and the discrimination in a positive, in a good sense with that word, discrimination, to know what's good information, what's useful, because it's again the funnel of information that data-driven systems can feed us means that we do need to select. And I don't know if you managed to listen to the preceding podcast, the conversation I had with Matt Bartlett, who's doing his doctorate at Columbia on this. And it was he who introduced me to this current use of the term hallucination. I was aware that through asking ChatGPT to answer several questions that it makes stuff up, and it just, but the notion of hallucination is a very useful one. It made stuff up about me. It invented information that was just completely wrong, and so our filters have to be enormously good. Our filters are better, or need to be better, than those of AI, don't they? And it's I can't remember who it was. Was it James Herndon? Someone is an educational writer. I think his book called How to Survive in Your Native Land. He said forgive the terminology. He said the one product of good education is to have a bulletproof bullshit detector. and that's what you should come out with, and I hope that your experiment sounds absolutely fabulous if what it also produces is that trash detector along the way, because it's much too easy to regurgitate too much information. So I mean, what you're teaching, I hope, is the good version of discrimination, that we need to discriminate between what's worth knowing and what's not, what's good information, what's not. And discrimination has, for very good reason, acquired a bad rep. But what you're doing here has huge educational significance, I suspect. So all power to you in that exercise. And I'd love to, I'll come back to you in a little while, maybe at the end of the semester to find out how this has worked. I mean, because I know essentially this AI revolution in education happened after I left the university system. So I've not had to bother with it, but I'm aware that my colleagues are tackling with this, not only having to deal with the substance of the courses that they teach, but also now the good or bad or indifferent input of AI. Intriguing stuff. Yeah. Go ahead. You were going to say?
Oh, no, I just appreciate your synopsis of really the additional information we have access to in the things that we think about, and the higher standard for observing that information, because there are so many ways you can be misguided. So you need to be much more discriminating in terms of how you think, how you frame your questions, and how you distill your answer.
Because the terminology used is that what the internet gives us is a fire hose of information.
Yes.
And from that, we then have to select what it is that's worth knowing or worth conveying. Because I know this years ago, there's a Australian professor of psychiatry, Paul Mullen, who's now working in Melbourne, but he was working in New Zealand a couple of decades ago. And he deals with persistent litigants, with those who, what's the word, there's a term for it, but yeah, the ones who keep on coming back to court. And he said one of the distinguishing features of those kinds of litigants is that they want to tell the court everything. They will turn up with a suitcase full of information, but the court doesn't need to know it. And the court has to say, no, I don't need to know that. I only need to know what's relevant to this case. But for such he calls them querulous litigants. Well, such people, everything is relevant, because everything shows how the system is against them or whatever it might be. And in a sense, what we've got is a querulous AI system, which tells you everything you need to know or everything it thinks you need to know. So discernment is maybe a better word than discrimination, given the bad rep of discrimination. So I applaud the work that you're doing in this. I'm aware that I've taken you well beyond the time that I said I would. But I'd have one last question for you. And I think it's a question that I come up with most of the people I have these conversations with. It's a question about access. Because our conversations about technology assume a level of access and accessibility. I mean, we started out in the 1970s with access to justice movement, books of the title of Access to Justice. And now we're adding a component. We have added a component of access to technology. Mm-hmm. And how do we manage? This is going to ask you a large policy question, to which, of course, you have the answer. Given that the design questions that you're talking about are technology dependent or technology rich, how do we build into that design the fact that not everybody has access to technology, either in terms of the technology itself or the capacity to use it well?
Well, it's a lovely question, Ian. I I have colleagues who are quite gifted and thoughtful in thinking about this question at a law school and thinking, what does access to justice mean? And I don't think there's a singular way of describing access or justice or technology that different people, different institutions are going to look at this differently. But even at a basic level on access means the price, the language, both technical and in cultural language, these could all shape what access looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it for? Is it for so I understand the situation and the options that I have better? Is it that I can get the book at the library for free that gives me the law? Or do I need to get a lawyer with that? Is it access to a lawyer who can guide me on the meaning of the law and the boundaries and where they came from? Does it mean what is justice? My co-author Lisa Amsler wrote an article on, I think, 23 flavors of justice. There are many kinds of justice. So I think each one of those terms has a plethora of meanings that will matter more or less to different people in different parts of the world. And then to your next question, if we figure out what we're talking about and define our terms, then who will synthesize it and make it accessible in terms of use and meaning? I think asking the question is probably the valuable step here, rather than finding an answer, because it will vary across boundaries of people and places.
Yeah. And I guess also, as I mentioned to Matt in my conversation with him a couple of weeks ago, that he's embarking on a 3 or 4 year project of writing a PhD. But by the time he finishes it, he's going to have to go back and start all over again, because four years in this game is an eternity. And if you think what has changed and what will change in over that period, particularly in the technology field, it's quite daunting. But we should end on a more optimistic note than that.
But I think your point is Amy and I are worried about the same question as Matt, is things are going to change faster than we can write. And I think we can see the direction that it goes. What is it that people seem to be demanding more of? What is it that's not so valuable as we thought? So maybe we can track the direction and the magnitude of that.
Well, and as I take it from your last 40 minutes of conversation, what you're outlining is principles, and principles in that sense are enduring. I mean, the actual details, and the, particularly in the field of technology, the details will change, but the principles have to be enduring. And that, I think, is what you're underscoring, which I think is the valuable part and at the core of your concern with ethics as well. Jan, I think on that point, and again, because I've dragged you well over the time that I said I would, but I do appreciate your time. We should finish here, but thank you so much for taking the time. Do appreciate that, and I look forward to this being up online so that people can hear the conversation. So, thank you so much, and do stay online for a second after I stop the recording.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ian, for a delightful conversation.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.